Welcome one and all to the world's only podcast, the only podcast in the world, brought to you each month from the AOS 21 Podcast Network, hosted on Podomatic. And now for our commentators, Ian Roberts and Joshua Silberman.
So I saw something on the interwebs this week.
Yeah?
You know, if you say 2022, it means 2022?
Oh, God. Like a C. Oh, no, 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 no! Oh.
We're in for yet another rough year.
No, no. So when you say sequels are worse than the original or they're better, what would worse or better mean in this case?
I mean, I think we know what better is. I think we know what worse is. If you want to find out, listen to our regular episode. Speaking thereof, welcome to the New Year's Eve edition of the world's only podcast, the only podcast in the world. This is our annual fifth segment episode. Ian, how are you? And do you want to tell the listeners what the heck the fifth segment is?
So I'm doing pretty well, Silby. So the fifth segment, every month we record five segments. And in a typical episode, we put about four of those segments out, and the fifth we hold in reserve, you know, just because we like to tease people like that. But here's what you get to hear, some of the fifth segments that we did not release over the course of the year. So we're going back in time with these.
And actually, I looked it up. These particular fifth segments are all through the summer, so May through August. Kind of interesting.
It was quite the summer. People were allowed to go do stuff again, so there was more news.
All right. That being said, shall we hop right into it?
Let's go. Back in May, Silby and I talked about the sale of the Tribune Company to Alden Global Capital. The sale alone might not be newsworthy, but it did point to a larger trend of local news outlets being swallowed up by conglomerates that have little financial interest in propping up coverage of local events. We talk about the implications of the sale and provide some possible solutions.
I don't really follow this particular brand of news very much, but I did find this interesting. So the Chicago Tribune, or the company that owns the Chicago Tribune, was recently bought by a group called Alden Global Capital, AGC, for the sake of this segment. This is significant because it follows a trend of kind of these mid-tier, even major newspapers in, no offense, second-tier cities. Like, I'm not saying Chicago's a second tier. I'm just saying it's not New York or LA.
Thank God.
and yes, I'll agree to that too. But it follows this trend of these kind of local major papers falling under the ownership of these large firms that really have it as either a vanity asset or an asset meant to be spun off and sold. And the result is, unfortunately, more budget-efficient journalism, which is just a nice way of saying jobs are cut, resources are cut, and journalism just doesn't do the best job that it can. And AGC itself has a reputation for cutting costs and then spinning off assets. And this is really in contrast to what we've seen for some other papers like, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post, but I'll get to that in a minute. I mean, Ian, you have some pretty deep ties to Chicago, so I'll let you speak on this first.
It's kind of weird because I've been out here in these so long. I actually have stronger ties to another paper under that banner, the Baltimore Sun. My in-laws subscribed to the print edition of the Sun for years. I don't even know if they do anymore, but I watched over 6 or 7 years as the paper itself got physically thinner, features were cut, reporters were laid off, because that's what happens. And now they're owned by the, you know, AGC, who has a reputation for cost cutting. So they cut jobs, they sell off real estate assets. And it's not even like right-wing hackery. So I honestly don't know which would be worse. Like they're not turning the paper into this Trump organ kind of a thing. It's just pure greed. It's just, we're gonna strip this for parts for everything it's worth. You mentioned sort of like a vanity holding, but it's really not that if you see the way that local journalism, local papers have been going. It's so hard to keep going. I think the other party that was trying to buy this thing, it was a consortium of a Swiss billionaire and a Maryland businessman who basically backed out after further research indicated that it would be far more challenging than the Swiss billionaire first anticipated. I think they have a few more weeks to mount a new offer, but it says something to say, okay, well, there's no real money in this. And I think that's true for almost all, certain, I think I would say all, almost all local media and certainly papers. Like financially, it doesn't make sense the way it used to. And now we're coming to a situation here where it's just a few big national papers, which is a terrifying thought.
Yeah. And so let's talk about some of the places where it did go right for these national papers. And the two biggest examples I have are the New York Times and the Washington Post, which have two different very models of kind of how they kind of managed to stay afloat. When I forget when they actually did this, but at one point, the New York Times did establish an actual paywall. I think the way their system works is they allow something like 3 or 4 free articles a month, and then a paywall comes up. Might even be less at this point. And many people, when it first came out, thought, oh, there's too much free news out there. Nobody's going to really go for this. But they've actually thrived. Their advertising revenue is down, but their subscription revenue is way, way, way up. I mean, I actually subscribe to them. And yes, I kind of do this thing where I share it, so I don't pay the full cost, but, you know, half a subscription is better than none, we could say. Contrast that also to the Washington Post, where it's basically been saved by a billionaire, and I do use that term correctly. There's an analysis I'm going to link to from CNN that basically says that under Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post has managed to increase its circulation, increase its reputation, increase its reporting resources. I mean, they've really become the newspaper for national politics. And in on reflection of this, that's not necessarily the best thing in the world, because I don't know how much you read the Washington Post, but I feel like they've managed to take over this brand of politics at the expense of local reporting.
Yeah, I do read the Post. I admit I don't go to them for a lot of the local news so much. I go to sort of smaller, the city I live in does produce like a paper that goes around once a month about, hey, here's the stuff the city council's up to. And I think that's kind of what you have to rely on. But then you're in a place where you're relying on your city to report its own doings, which is not great. Yeah, the Post has done a pretty good job. A few years after Bezos bought the paper, they put on this appearance of being the paper that was going to stand up to Trump. You remember the Democracy Dies in Darkness thing?
Still there.
Yeah. They still use it. And I think, you know, they were better than the New York Times was on the being the political paper. I think the Times was pretty lousy when it came to a lot of Trump administration coverage. But overall, they were still not great. But it was a lot of savvy marketing with how you do that. So that does increase subscription costs, right? Like, I think it's been less steady than the New York Times has, so I'm a little bit more worried about it, but they saw a huge subscription blow up shortly after Trump took office. Local papers can't really rely on that. Local papers have to do the, frankly, boring work of, oh, here's what your city council did, here's some stuff going on around town. That's not like, it's not the breathless, you need to read this right now, because local papers just can't produce that same thing. So how does local paper do that? What can you do with this? My advice has always been to subscribe to your local paper. That's increasingly hard. In my case, my local paper is the Post. And they do, like you said, they do a pretty good job covering DC government, especially when something is going wrong there. But they really do focus most of the attention on national government, which I'm glad someone's doing. I think they do a better job of it than any of the other major papers.
And that kind of goes back to the paywall model with the New York Times. I mean, they are this massive global paper that covers international news from an American perspective in a way that I don't think anyone else can. And because of the size and scope of the New York City government and even the New York State government, I would argue that they actually do a pretty good job covering state and local news, at least local to us. This has created a conundrum, though, for other local newspapers. You say I've got, and again, I'm just pulling numbers out of my butt here. Say you got $10 to spend on news. What are you going to spend that on? Are you going to spend it on a local paper that's just covering city council stuff? Or are you going to spend it on an online subscription to the Times that's going to give you global news? I think many, many people, or at least more people than you think, are going to take the latter.
I spent my $10 on candy. I'm sorry.
Some would argue that's even worse. But anyway, that has actually created this problem that these other papers, the Times, the Post, even the LA Times have done so well in their paywall models and offering digital subscriptions that they're kind of crowding out local news sources. So, you know, taking all this together, I'm really not sure what local news can do. Now, there isn't really a hyper local paper I can subscribe to. I do subscribe to The Patch, which mostly functions on local advertising.
And that's a broader national organization too, right?
Yeah, they do. I'm just using that as an example. I mean, I don't know anything for my own hometown here in New Jersey that is produced absolutely locally. Maybe I could find something, maybe something doesn't exist anymore, but that's also part of the problem. And I'm not sure what I could do. When I was thinking up things that could be done, I mean, some could argue maybe these local papers in certain areas could share resources, create more regional brands.
Yeah, I had an idea too, on that wavelength of, this is going to get dystopian here, but because I think we are headed toward a place where it's just going to be two or three or four large national papers. What if the Washington Post and New York Times, places like that, start doing local desks? Like, for example, New York Times desk in Salt Lake City or something. And maybe you subscribe at a lower rate to just get the news from Salt Lake. Like, it's okay, $2 for this. And then it's, you know, $5 for the full paper or whatever. Like, is that a viable model? Kind of like you talked about Patch, it's a similar, but just doing it nationwide. Is that something that could be done?
Besides the subscription, I guess it's not much different from Patch. Honestly, when you said, you know, here's the local desk in, say, Salt Lake City, the first place I went to was, okay, here's the local desk in Kabul. It sounds like you're covering it in a war zone.
From what I hear, Salt Lake City is very nice. I know some people who have lived there.
It's just the way it sounded. I mean, the other thing to look at is...
Like Kabul, it's mountainous and no one can conquer it.
The other thing to look at is this kind of adopt-a-paper model. I mean, it worked with Bezos and the Post, but I really that's probably going to be a one-off. I can't imagine that, A, there are enough billionaires out there who want papers. B, I can't imagine, because you said, you know, this whole thing with the Chicago Tribune. Bezos can probably sustain the losses that the Post is going to take, at least in the first, you know, couple years of his ownership. Not everyone can do that. You talked about kind of that papers don't really make money. I mean, that's true. There's a lot of resources that go into this. And if you take things like inflation, travel expenses, and whatever into account, and getting it harder and harder to get into places that, say, the Chicago Tribune would cover, you know, it costs money to do this. And, you know, who has the money?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, forget turning a profit, which I don't think news outlets should have to do anyway. Expenses outpace revenue. They can't break even.
And then the third thing is, and this is kind of the scariest all to me, is the government. I mean, yeah, say what you will about the government bringing in news, but could you imagine Trump controlling the purse strings of the Washington Post and the New York Times?
I think you're jumping somewhere where we haven't really gone yet. Yes, obviously that would be a horrible thing. I don't think you need that. I think if there were one government option plus some other private options, that's one thing.
We have PBS, and that's not saving the day.
Now NPR, are they public or private these days? I can't even remember.
I thought they are public. They generally will rely on donations, but they also rely on a lot of money from the government, money that was threatened under the Trump administration.
Yeah, yeah. I've also started to think about how local TV stations do this, and this is this might be my urban privilege showing, but at least here we have some of the best local coverage comes from local TV affiliates online presence, like WTTG, WUSA.
We do too, but that's a spinoff of being near New York City.
Yeah, are you going to get that in Nebraska?
Correct. And unfortunately, it's going to lead to a Sinclair News type scenario.
That's the other thing I was talking about early on in the segment, is what's going on here is mostly just a business thing where these things are hard to keep afloat. And it's not like these things are being bought up by right-wing outlets to make them into rags. They're just going out of business because they're being stripped for parts because it's not financially viable for the people who buy them. And I honestly don't know which would be worse.
We got to wrap up here. So I think maybe for my concluding thought as I take this whole discussion together, maybe part of the way to get out of this is places like the Chicago Tribune and other papers that are, let's call them mid-majors, don't focus so much internationally and try to focus more locally. They're going to give up a lot of prestige to do that, but I think it could, in theory, make their operating expenses a lot more manageable. Leave, and I know this sounds terrible to sound, but like leave the national, international stuff to the big guys. Let the New York Times cover Kabul. Let the Washington Post cover the Capitol. You know, focus on the dead people voting in Chicago. That should be your beat. I mean, it's not an exact analogy given everything we talked about, but the Times has done an amazing, amazing job covering Cuomo's shortcomings with nursing homes during the COVID pandemic.
No, I would say like they have, but what if you have a governor in another state, you're having a similar problem as Cuomo, who's covering it?
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like Cleveland, the Cleveland newspaper should be covering that for something for Ohio. They shouldn't be trying to cover national news. And that's, maybe it's a dystopian thing, but I can't see a better way out of it.
Yeah. I'm going to post an analysis. Talk about, you know, in the last 15 years, 1,800 U.S. papers have shut down. Some of those, you know, were a century old. Some of them were very young. Some were owned by local families. Some were owned by a larger consortia, but they all fell. And there's a nasty cycle here because getting news from the internet, or worse, cable news, you know, led people to abandon their local paper. Then those papers shut down, forcing more people to go to, wait for it, internet and cable news. And how many times have you Googled a news story? You talked about this a little bit earlier. And then you run to a bunch of those, you're out of free articles notices. And they notice that the stuff that doesn't do those paywalls tends not to be very good news. A lot of it is actively terrible.
Because they're marketing. Like, they're not giving news. They are marketing their story.
Yeah, that's right. We started getting the option of having news for free, and we took it, and then we got what we paid for. You know, and it's like this, the whole streaming problem too. Like, I'm not gonna pay for every option that's out there. No one's gonna do that. But there needs to be some option.
This won't work for everybody, but at least maybe to proliferate the access to news a little more, you can follow the model that I do with streaming, which is sharing, which is granted, I have the logistical knowledge and expertise to do this. I have a whole spreadsheet that covers my streaming services, my newspaper subscriptions, with who I'm sharing it with, what I'm paying. And basically, I get all the streaming services, all the major ones, for $30 a month. And that's pretty good for all the content I get.
That does work, but if you're someone who lives, again, in Salt Lake City, and you can get the New York Times there, obviously people do, but they're
exactly
not covering what's going on in Utah.
Right, right.
And what's the solution to that?
And that's what I'm not sure about. I'm just trying to think of the proliferation of news, which really doesn't help here, but okay.
No, it doesn't.
Anything else on this?
No, I think that's it. I think, you know, it's bad.
Yeah. Okay, moving on.
Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by...
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/AOS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
In June, Ian and I talked about the declining U.S. and Western birth rates. Now, it's no mystery that the U.S. birth rate has been declining for what many believe is a lack of financial and government support. But what was so interesting to me, and the reason I really wanted to do this segment, was because the same thing appears to be happening in Europe?
All right, so with census data that's been released recently, we've seen a continuation of a growing trend, which is a slowing U.S. birth rate. However, this is in line with the rest of the Western world, wherein birth rates are slowing in general. Why is this a bad thing? A slowing birth rate is eventually going to lead to less workers, which means less tax revenue, less people to take care of the elderly. I mean, overall, in theory, and we'll get to that later, it's bad for standard of living in general. So we thought it might be interesting to look at why we think this is. I will link to the actual numbers, but because I didn't want to get bogged down on a numbers discussion, but I did want to look at some facets of this discussion. And the first and top of the list, obviously, is the lack of family-friendly policies in the U.S. that have just been exacerbated by COVID-19. I mean, when COVID-19 came, everything that people relied on for both childcare and work just got shut down. You know, we're talking schools, daycare centers, everything. And people said that that kind of was just a wake-up call to how little backup planning we have. But I'm kind of scratching my head at that one. And Ian, I'm hoping you can explain this to me a little more as someone who has a child. You know, everything was shut down. What backups were we looking at here? It's not like we could enforce having daycare centers when the daycare centers were shut down.
Yeah, you're very much left on your own in that situation. Now, I was lucky that, you know, my employer understood the situation. It's always great, just a heads up for you, like if your direct supervisor has kids of their own, that helps a lot because they get it. And so I was very lucky to have that. So during the, 6 or 8 weeks that my daughter's daycare was shut down, I was with her most of the day because my wife was not in a job where she could just leave. She had to be there on. So I was juggling a lot of that. And it was really draining. And we were relatively lucky. There's some people who really did have to choose between job and take care of their kids. Some people end up just getting laid off and then take care of their kid. But then now there's this other thing about how do you pay for this? And some of this is the lack of family-friendly policies comes from, again, it's the rising cost of living and stagnant wages. For a big chunk of my childhood, I think I had at least one of my parents always home. You know, when I was really young, it was my mom. Later, it was my dad. And then a generation before that, one salary could support a family of 5 kids, 7 kids, and a solid middle-class lifestyle. And that's gone. And it's replaced by the necessity of childcare. I think I know people, I'm sure you know people, where one partner ends up quitting their job because it actually ends up saving them money.
And I should note here that 9 times out of 10, it is the woman, because usually in a heterosexual relationship, the man makes more than the woman for reasons we just can't get into right now.
Or won't get into, because that's a lot. But yeah, that is true.
And when I say really, I mean time limits.
Again, and debt is rising, student debt, difficulty of finding a house right now. I don't know how much you know about this, but the housing market is just a nightmare for anyone trying to buy.
We're aware. We are very aware.
Yeah, it's and none of this is conducive to kids. I think there's also some social elements of now where women and couples are able to put it off for a long time. I think that reflects a social change that is positive, where parenthood is more of a choice. And I think that's a good thing. It makes for better parents, for one thing, because at least theoretically, people who have kids who are choosing to have kids are going to make better parents. Again, at least theoretically. So
I'll find out in a couple of months.
Yeah, dude, there's so much. Like, maybe we'll do a segment on some advice at some point, but there's going to be some stuff that you were not prepared for, and other stuff you don't understand how well you already are prepared. It's going to be so many fun surprises.
All right.
The point is, this lack of family support system comes from the fact that for a long time things were working really well. Then relatively fast, over a period of 20 or 30 years, things changed dramatically. And now there's a resistance to doing anything kind of thing. And now we have this debate about, okay, should we give parents money specifically to pay for daycare? When my feeling is just give the parents the money and let them decide whether they want to use that to have for one parent to stay at home. Because some people prefer being a house parent and they should get to make that choice. And other people can say, we'll put this toward, you know, daycare, because we both
and I think a lot of that a lot of the counter to that argument comes that if you give parents the money, the choice is going to be for the woman to stay home. And I don't think a lot of people are prepared to accept that argument. Of course, I'm saying this from a perspective that I'm not a parent yet,
In practice, I think that you will see a lot of that, but they're also, I saw that with my parents when I was young. It was my mom staying home and then later it was my dad, because I think career shifts happen where you realize, oh, you know, your wife is able to suddenly make a lot more money. So I'm like, okay, maybe I'll stay home for a bit and just take a break from this. But that's also, at least from my perspective, kind of hard to do, because at some point your kids are old enough where you don't need to be around. Like, you don't need to be around all the time when they're in high school, for example. And so now you kind of need to restart your career. And that's a really rough place to be also.
Yeah. Which is why I have so much stock in these work from home technologies, especially the ones I've been pushing. But that's a discussion for another day. I do want to shift now overseas to countries that do have what are considered better, much better family friendly policies, daycare, particularly maternity and paternity leave. But even there, we're seeing in some cases steeper declines in birth rates, which is kind of pointing to something else that I think a lot of people don't want to discuss, which is the feeling that, as you alluded to, many couples, and I feel especially women, are choosing to put aside having kids. I'm going to link to a Vogue article from the UK that says, that was released pre-pandemic, that talks about the stigma surrounding not choosing to have children and women standing up and saying, you know what, I saw this being a burden to my own mother. I don't want it for me. And again, this is coming from countries that really do have good family-friendly policies.
Because again, I think this comes down to personal choice about, you know, do I really want a kid? I think there's less pressure, not no pressure, but less pressure about, oh, you need to give me grandkids kind of a thing. And I think this is very good. I think some of the, you know, unintended pregnancies are down. You know, we'll see what abortion restrictions in the U.S. have to say about that. But even then, I think we're generally better about education. We used to be, contraception is widely available for now. I think it's just a matter of people realize they don't need to. And culturally, you know, it was always thought, oh, I think there's still an assumption broader culturally and economically that, oh, we need more kids. We can't have this. You know, there's a medium-term problem with regard to labor, especially now that we have falling immigration rates in the U.S. I guess they're back up a little bit.
And across the EU. Let's not kid ourselves here.
That, oh, okay, so you're going to have, you know, we're already kind of dealing with this problem with the aging boomers, right? Whereas, okay, the labor market is shifting in a bad direction. A lot of the aging population living longer is also part of it. But I think in the long term, this is definitely a good thing. Certainly environmentally, it's a very good thing to have fewer people using fewer resources. I know that go ahead.
I was going to say that actually pivots into the last track. If you want to get into your final point, but that is literally the best transition I can think of to get into the last track of this.
Yeah. And you talk about across a lot of the rest of the world. Yeah, they still have higher birth rates, but also those are parts of the world where resources are used less. You know, Americans use five times as many resources as anyone else. So if anyone,
only five, we got to do better.
I mean, I think I'm comparing it to like Germany rather than say,
yeah,
India.
I know.
You know, so if anyone has the burden of having to maybe slow down a little bit, it would be us, frankly.
In terms of resource usage, you mean?
In terms of birth rates to decrease overall resource usage, yeah.
Yeah. Which brings it again to the last facet, which is, you know, despite these declining birth rates, on the whole, the world population is still rising, mostly in the places that are known as the developing world, Africa, South Asia. Birth rates are still through the roof. In places with high poverty, you are typically going to see larger birth rates, if for no other reason that, you know, a woman might have, say, six children, only four of them survive.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's also a lot of that part of the world, the child seen as investment, because from the age of, what, five or six, they can start working for you on, you know, whatever business you own or whatever, you know, if it's on a farm, they can help with that, which is where we were for a long time. And once society has developed past a certain point, okay, we don't really need that anymore. We'll pay someone else to do it and let children have their childhood. So it's still kind of a necessity in those parts of the world, too.
There's an interesting book I'm going to mention out there. Well, actually, that'll be my closing thought. But this is a good time, I think, to get into closing thoughts. So when we started this segment, I was looking at, much in the same way Western Europe was looking at ways to increase the birth rate and see how we can sort of stabilize it. You know, I think my favorite one was kind of Denmark started a campaign to get couples to go on vacation more, forgetting that they can't exactly ban them from taking condoms. I think that it was called Do It for Grandma. You talk about the pressure to have grandkids. But the more I looked at it, the less I'm concerned about this so-called declining population for the last reason we talked about, which is it is less people using resources. And, you know, maybe I'm putting too much stock in technology. Maybe it's going to lead to the rise of the Terminators. But I do think technologically we can work around the issue of caring for the aging population. I mean, if anything, Japan's going to figure it out for us. They kind of have to at this point. There's an interesting book out there. I know it's in terms of reading comprehension, it's not exactly high level, but if you ever read Dan Brown's Inferno, which is,
not.
You know, the same guy, he's the same guy who did the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
but it basically puts a premise of overpopulation into perspective. And like one, I'm not going to spoil the book, but it does give one interesting way to deal with it. That's, I don't know, kind of terrible, but the more I think about it, is probably the most humane way I can think of. And so just taken together, you know, the family-friendly policies, which we do need, which gives women more control, I think, of their lives, which is something that up until maybe the invention of the pill itself, they haven't really had, because even in the cases of accidental pregnancy, they're the one who has to bear the cost. Taken all together, I am not particularly concerned about the declining birth rate.
No, neither am I. There was a thought at the beginning of the pandemic that this is going to lead to a higher birth rate. For the New York Times article we're going to link to, that wasn't the case. I think births were down most sharply this past December, 8% from the previous December, and that's when babies conceived at the start of the pandemic would have been born. And the joke to that saying that, oh, there's going to be a pandemic baby boom. No, there's going to be a vasectomy boom. And the stats on that don't hold up either. But I'll say that, Sylvie, you're about to learn that if you want to lose all control of your life, bring a child into the house. Because they're all little chaos agents. And yeah, in the past year, people have struggled for any kind of control. But we can't think that's a limited thing. Even pre-pandemic, people have been feeling less secure in their financial position and the stability of the world around them. So why introduce a child unless you absolutely have to? And we're seeing the results of that now. But that, like you said, that's not entirely a bad thing. Maybe this is how we regain control. You're more the Star Trek guy. I know Star Trek is, so I'll defer to you on the Star Trek is post-scarcity. But I also kind of think, like, they probably have a really stable birth rate in that universe. That's how you kind of reach utopia, when you have more control.
You know, in the Star Trek universe, a lot of the starships, the ones that are not on the dangerous missions, the ones that are just explore-based, take their children with them. That's how they get around the family aspect. They take their children with them to explore.
Like generation ships.
Yeah. Well, not even just generation ships, because in theory, faster than light travel. I mean, I don't want to get into it, but families live together and explore those worlds together.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's so... Yeah, there's a lot of hand-wringing about this, but I don't quite understand why. It's fine. All right, you want to move on?
Absolutely.
Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by...
So I'm looking for some Expos merch, but all I'm seeing are old Andre Dawson jerseys. Do you know where I can find some more recent stuff?
Well, I don't know who, what, or where the Expos are, but I can tell you that you can now pick up Washington Nationals gear from our friends over at Fanatics. Just head over to AOS21.com/theworldsonlypodcast and click on the banner at the top of our page to get great deals on World Championship Washington Nationals merchandise today.
Hey, wow, Fanatics actually has Expos stuff. This is a great site. In July, we covered the exploding cost of housing in the U.S. We explored the causes and solutions to this, because the housing market as it stands leaves a lot of people out in the cold, often literally. At one point, I think we hoped for a housing market crash. As of this recording, that crash has not happened. Anyway, here's a segment. In a segment we recorded but did not release last month, stay tuned for our year-end episode in December, we talked about low birth rates in the U.S., and we very briefly touched on the factor of housing being difficult to acquire right now, which is true, and not just for people of childbearing age. The pandemic is seemingly coming to an end, but the legacy of layoffs continues, and as eviction moratoriums begin to lift, more people find their housing situation a little tenuous. And then there's the real estate market inflating out of control. Since the start of the pandemic, the median sale price for existing homes across the country climbed 16%. Now, one culprit is private equity firms who have been buying up subdivisions and single-family homes, causing their prices to skyrocket. Basically doing what house flippers have been doing, but on a macro scale, and we'll come back to them. Another issue is the lack of home building. In the last 25 years, the number of homes in the U.S. has risen by 25%. The population has risen by 24%. Now, that sounds like it's enough homes, but in the 25 years before that, because of, you know, things like smaller families, the number of homes increased by 60% to accommodate the population growth of 30%, and we are not building anywhere near on that scale right now. And so now we come back to a situation where a whole lot of people are suddenly going to be needing new homes, or at least not even new homes, but just homes.
Available
homes, yes. Now, Sylvie, I own a house that's gone up in value well beyond its actual worth. And you told me last, you know, that you know how bad the housing market is. I assume that's because you've been trying to look for one.
Yeah, we've been looking for one. We started right before the pandemic. And then when the pandemic hit and prices got out of control, we decided to stay still. And we've opted to renew our lease because right now we're in a good apartment situation. And, you know, housing outside has skyrocketed. And I won't lie. I mean, my wife and I, we don't have any property investments right now. We're both in secure jobs, thankfully. the best thing I can hope for in terms of the real estate market is a housing bubble. And I know that could cause a lot of pain to a lot of people, but it's kind of what I'm hoping for over the next year so that prices do come down dramatically. Does that make me a bad person?
Only a little. It's understandable, though, because it's kind of like that's the only way you're going to see things come back to a reasonable place for you to be able to buy a house, especially with a kid on the way. That's kind of something you would like to have. I don't think, you know, it's obviously you can't have a kid in an apartment. We're glad we didn't because our daughter was colicky and that would have been a nightmare for our neighbors. But, you know, it's one of those things like, yeah, in order for you to do something you feel you need to do, you need something. The only other option, well, not the only other option, we'll get to that, would be for a crash. The solution here would be to build more housing, but that's been way, way down. It's not because there aren't construction companies willing to do it. It's because in a lot of places, people just don't want that. I'm going to talk about, just for a second, if I may, something that's happening right where I live. There's a park about a mile away from where I live on the outskirts of town. And it used to be a golf course. That golf course went under because there are too many golf courses around here. Now, the town wanted to turn that into an area for low-income housing. And I think there was a plan for veteran housing there as well. But that got a lot of pushback because there are a lot of people who want to keep that as a park. And I get it. I like parks too, but we have a lot of them here. And, you know, while some people might like their home values going up like this, it's not good long-term, even for the owners, by the way. Just think about what property taxes look like. Now, that whole debate has been frozen since the pandemic started, which honestly probably gives the NIMBY side a little more momentum because things just stopped. And I know that seems very local and very boring, but that story is playing out all over the country.
Oh, God, yeah. My favorite example is actually during the pandemic. I think it was either during the pandemic or right before the pandemic, there was a massive pushback in New York City about turning old hotels into homeless shelters for single men, which is the majority of the homeless population in New York City. It was an area that is colloquially called Millionaire's Row because guess what? A lot of rich people live there and they push back against it hard. NIMBYism, in my mind, is probably the biggest hit I have against progressivism because, you know, yes, it happens all over the country, but I find that in areas with the most heavily concentrated pockets of poverty in this country, that's where it's the most fervent. New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, people who are in their homes already will do everything they can for the homeless population, except the one thing that actually needs to be done, which is build more homes in the areas that the homeless population are for the reasons you said. And in some ways, I get it. I live in a mixed income area myself, and I'm fine with it for the most part. You know, my apartment's nice. The neighborhood's nice. We got the pool next door. But man, do we have some quality of life issues. And I'm sorry if this seems like it's painting a broad brush on people, but there are definitely some things I can say and things that some people worry about when it comes to affordable housing. For example, drug use. And I get that might be a mental health thing, but it's also the more simple stuff like leaving trash out, smoking weed in places where other people can see it. Or not see it, I'm sorry, like really smell it without venting, playing loud music at 2 a.m. in the morning. And these are all things that have happened at my complex. And I want mixed neighborhoods to happen. I want to see that come in. But I also admit that the NIMBYs now do have an argument.
I would say most of the behaviors you're describing happen among all classes of people. The difference is when it happens among wealthy people who have space, it happens as a place without other people around.
Are they able to like negotiate it out better? Because I feel like the people, like for example, we've had massive incidences here of before the pandemic of people partying up in the common room, and they won't listen to anybody except the cops. No, we don't want to call the police on them, but they're the only people that they listen to. If it was a matter of say, okay, yeah, we'll turn down the music, or okay, yeah, we understand it's 2 a.m., that's fine. It's not just a matter of space. It's a matter of people living together and having the common decency to actually respect each other's boundaries.
That's what I meant about space. If they're doing it in sort of a single family home where houses are spaced far apart from one another.
But then that comes back to the question, can we all live together?
That's a very big question.
Yeah, and it's one I know we're not going to solve on the podcast. I'm sorry if I got off track here.
It comes back to without building those and without building. I think you know with low income housing you talk about apartment rental units, things like that.
Or even townhouses that are really close together.
Which townhouses are by definition they're very close together, and we're not really doing that. Instead we've basically kind of stopped building, and as a result we're seeing I mentioned in the intro that this is kind of like house flipping run amok, and it's kind of a fun idea. I can see the appeal, even if it's something I would never do. And yes, you should see your house as an investment, but it's come at the expense of having places to live. People buy these places just to turn a middle-income home or a starter home into, oh, this is slightly higher. This is now out of the reach of someone who might have been able to buy it before. Like, you've been in my neighborhood, and it's been a while. You saw it's a lot of smaller, it's starter homes is the idea here. And there's a trend a little while ago of someone would buy the lot and then tear down the existing house and then build a much bigger one, something that takes up, I'm not even exaggerating, 70 to 80% of the lot space. And the town where I live recently just said, just for our neighborhood, because it was happening a lot here, said, you can't do that anymore. They limit, I can't remember what the percentage was, but it can't be more than a certain percentage of the lot size. Because what we have now is a lot of small starter homes. And then, you know, every like fifth house is a McMansion. It looks really weird. And it's made all the property values go up. I mentioned, I think my house has gone up 20% since we bought it almost 4 years ago. And I know that doesn't reflect the actual value of this house because I live here. It's complete. That is the definition of a bubble.
Okay, so we got to wrap up soon. And I'm going to wrap up by talking about this idea of inflation, which is this, obviously, it's a fear given the recent investments, and I do mean investments by the federal government. But then I think it was the New York Times, I'll have to post the actual source, but it pointed out something interesting. Lumber prices are falling. And in a market like this, you would kind of be surprised that lumber prices are falling, but it's the first major raw material, especially when it comes to housing, that we've seen fall in a while, which could take the bite out of the inflation argument, which in my mind, given our discussion, kind of puts more back into the NIMBYism argument that, okay, the materials are there, the willingness to build is there, the people are there who want to buy this stuff. It's just a matter of getting those who are already in the areas where the space is available to allow the type of housing we need. And I know most of us like single family homes. That's probably what I'm going to buy because that's what is available. But, you know, my wife grew up in a multifamily apartment in Israel. I would gladly buy into a multifamily apartment and rent for the rest of my life. I love the idea of somebody else taking care of the maintenance for me.
I really miss that. I really do.
But that's simply not feasible right now. So as I've said it earlier, NIMBYism is probably my biggest knock against progressivism, probably will be until they come around and start doing the issues locally that they claim to care about nationally.
Yeah, it's a larger discussion about NIMBYism. I think the only thing we disagree with there is like it happens in progressive areas because that's where you see the population density and that's where you see these debates happen. It is the only reason.
It's also where you see the biggest pockets of homelessness. It's the area where you need it the most.
Yeah, exactly. So you would absolutely see that thing in areas where people wanted to live as desperately as they want to live in places like San Francisco or to a much lesser extent where I live.
Right. But they're the ones who actually claim they care about it. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
So yeah, long story short, housing bubble coming. Enjoy everybody.
I know I will, unfortunately. All right. Ready to move on?
Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hello, listeners. If you like the World's Only Podcast, then you'll love our merchandise, right, Ian?
I guarantee.
Head on over to tpublic.com/AOS21, that's AOIS21, for all the latest and greatest in World's Only merchandise. Also check out the merchandise of other AOS21 podcasts as well.
I guarantee.
So we're going to end with a segment we recorded in August on international travel. Now, when we recorded this segment, I had just returned from a trip abroad with my wife. And because of the rise of Delta, we encountered a ton of different travel requirements, restrictions, documentations, you name it. Why is this relevant again? Well, if you look in the news, the Omicron variant is rising, and I feel a staggering sense of deja vu.
In the beginning of our intro, I talked about how I recently got back from a baby moon. And on the whole, the trip itself was really, really nice. You know, it was good to visit family and friends in Israel. It was good to go to Barcelona. It was good to go to Dubrovnik in Croatia. And, you know, for me and my wife to spend a week by ourselves and another week with family. So, you know, that was really nice. But getting from country to country was both stressful and a nightmare. And the whole point of this trip, I think, was to try to relax, you know, get my wife, who is at the time of the recording about 7.5 months pregnant, kind of, you know, more in a relaxed mood, able to go into that third trimester with a clear head. And for the most part, we accomplished that. But crossing borders was incredibly difficult, especially going from Israel to Spain. Now, the reason for that specifically was because while we were in Israel, the Israeli government declared Spain a so-called red country because of COVID cases the day before we left. And that's just something, you know, we can't anticipate. We read every regulation, we prepared for every test, but even still, you know, we got caught up in the Israeli bureaucracy. We actually had to stay in Israel an extra day to clear up some bureaucratic issues that would take too long to describe on this podcast. So it made me think about where we currently stand with international travel. I mean, not only is it a huge source of economic revenue for many places, Croatia, for example, where I was, but I also think it's become a cultural touchstone of our civilization, the ability to actually go and see other cultures and other places. And frankly, I have argued for the past couple of years that airlines have made that much more difficult for a regular American family. And now I think it's the point where it's about to become outright impossible.
I'm not ready to say that I think this will become outright impossible just based on this. It kind of feels like the COVID restrictions, I think, will go away. I'm more and more of the mind that this is going to be like a 2-year-long slog. So 2 years from whenever this started. So I'm kind of thinking maybe by next summer, everything should be back in business. Everything should be fine.
This isn't about this summer.
I mean, yeah, that's true. But I've started thinking about past pandemics.
We'll be into the not omega. What's the next letter in the Greek alphabet, that whatever that variant's going to be?
Please don't ask me to learn the Greek alphabet.
I used to know it, but
Lambda?
Maybe.
All right.
I used to know it. I don't know it anymore.
Anyway, so and there was a huge boost in travel, both internationally and domestically, back in the spring when everyone felt safe. And I'm guessing that's probably when you booked your trip, was around April, May.
Yeah, we booked it in May, and then for mid July.
And so people start traveling, and that's when surges started happening all over. I do have a little bit of data on the countries you went to about what that looked like, and it was kind of about the time you were there is when. Things were going up, and even though all the countries you were in looks like they're doing pretty well with vaccination.
And that's the ironic part. I mean, especially Israel was doing great with vaccination. That's the whole reason we thought it'd be safe to go there in the first place.
I was surprised to see like they were doing really well, but they're now about 60% fully vaccinated, which seems way lower than should have been for this for now.
The big issue they're having is children, actually, which is sad in of itself, you know, and we're not even talking about people who can get vaccinated. So, you know, that's what makes it more difficult. But I digress.
I don't have numbers based. I don't know if these numbers are based on like adult population or if it's total population. So that would be worth looking into as well. And the glib solution here is say, you know, don't travel during this. And yeah, that's the ideal situation.
Which is also what the CDC is saying.
Yeah, but
technically,
it's not that easy. Like I said, you know, people started booking trips this past spring. But then things really start changing in a real way. And this is where I don't quite see this being a permanent shift. I feel like if the middle class stops traveling, it's because they get squeezed in other ways. But let me ask you this. How many different airports did you go through?
Let me count, including the U.S. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Five. Okay. At any of those, did you get to, you know, whatever, checkout desk or security or whatever, and you see the staff kind of looking at each other trying to remember what it is they're supposed to be doing?
Only in Israel.
Okay.
Because of that change the day before with Spain. Okay. And they took, I should argue, and I'm getting into a little semantics here. It was worse for my wife than it was for me. She is an Israeli national, with dual citizenship. So for me, they were ready to throw my out of the country. They're like, okay, you're American, get the hell out of here. My wife, you're Israeli, we don't want you traveling and coming back with a disease. So she was the one they actually tried to keep in country.
Interesting. Even with the American passport, they're not...
Correct.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, I kind of wonder about that because... And it's possible they were doing it in Spain and Croatia too, but if you don't speak the language, you might not know they're doing that. That's a very real part of this as well, as the expectations keep shifting. And I'm sure most people in a work situation have been here where policy changes and everyone's kind of like, wait, what are we doing now? Especially when the policy keeps changing. It's the people who have to enforce it are very confused.
I will say that once we got to the European Union, things were much easier. First, we were both traveling on American passports. And the only things we had to do was we had to fill out one form for each country, Spain and Croatia, in advance. And then show our vaccination cards upon arrival.
Okay.
There were no other tests. There were no other entry things. I mean, we were afraid that something was going to change. We were afraid of that at every border. But I got to tell you, at every place they stamped my passport, vaccination card, okay, stamp, go. Okay. Yeah, well, the only places I had a problem getting back into were Israel and the United States.
Okay, so some places it was working working pretty well. So that's something. How stressed did like the flight crews and everybody look?
Definitely. The flight crews were definitely more stressed going to Croatia than they were coming back to the U.S. And that was mostly because of mask enforcement. I mean, I will say that, you know, my wife and I even at one point asked a flight attendant to ask somebody else to put their mask on properly.
Okay, so masks on every flight you were on whole way.
Yes, no, every airline was enforcing masks. And I would also argue that masks were very prominent of all the places we were visiting. I would say they were taking it the most seriously in Spain.
Okay.
And that was probably because, as you said, cases were rising. Israel was kind of in this place of disbelief that this could be happening again, because, you know, they had such a high vaccination rate and they were going along so well, and their COVID cases were crashing when we booked these flights. So
yeah, and I was looking at it, Israel had hit a huge spike probably right after you left.
Yeah, and so that was starting while we were there. So for me, the question is, you know, is travel still worth it? And I want to say it is, because as I said, it is a big cultural touchstone. I mean, travel for the middle class is really only something we've seen, for lack of better words, take off since the 1980s. Before that, it really was an endeavor of the rich and, you know, the upper class. And while you are right, you know, the restrictions themselves won't last may only last for another year or two. I think the damage done via the airlines might be permanent. For example, in the work I'm in, there's been an explosion in work from home technology. A big revenue generator for these airlines was business travel. Now you've got people like me who literally specialize in technology to cut business travel probably by 2/3. And so once, you know, that revenue stream is gone, how else are they going to make their money? They're going to make their money by cutting staff, cutting routes. Really, the only way they're going to be able to make their money is from that upper tier level of travel.
Yeah. And the story is coming out about it might just be the way the internet focuses stories, but about flight attendants getting just a lot of crap from from even just a few passengers. There was a story about it was a Southwest. Southwest is no longer selling alcohol on flights.
United had to duct tape somebody to the seat. The United announced that flight crew was being disciplined, and then there was backlash against United for United disciplining the flight crew.
Yeah, that was a complicated story to me, because I feel like, no, it's not safe to duct tape in the seat, but also I get why they did it. These are instances of a few people making it harder for the rest of us. I don't know if it's the way that the internet amplifies stories more than they should be amplified, or if it's maybe something is broken in people's brains with regard to travel. Maybe they're just angry about the mask mandates. I don't know what it is.
I mean, for me, travel right now feels like a really dehumanizing experience. You are crammed into tiny seats that I don't think need to be that tiny.
Well, Silby, they need to make profit. So yes, they do need to be that tiny.
Look, they need to make profits, but look at also the bailout the airlines got. So they're doing fine. It's the way they're also building the planes. I mean, these planes, the way they're built right now, they don't have to be that small. They can be, you know, a foot or two wider, make more room for people, make it a little more comfortable to travel with kids, and then suddenly a family of four is able to fly again.
So travel, I mean, the actual traveling part, the en route part, was never a joy for most of us. And like you point out, it's gotten harder. You get, you know, smaller cabins, smaller seats.
And fees at every, you know, at every single turn. It's all only going to get worse. That's been my argument for this segment.
I do think, you know, I doubt this is permanent. If the American middle class stops traveling, it'll be for other reasons, like not being able to afford it, which, by the way, could happen. I don't think it's necessarily COVID related. In the U.S., we went through a period of, what was it, like 9 or 10 months where rules on COVID were stable-ish, like masks and distancing. But, you know, in the first few months of the pandemic, and then again these last few months, rules became chaotic, shifting by the day, because governments love looking like they're doing something. And it's made everyone crazier. Like, I don't know if it's because people expected everything to be fine by now. I know I kind of did last winter. I thought, okay, summer will be fine, and now, no, we're not. And now we're expected, okay, just go on about your lives, even though this thing is raging even harder than it was before. And I don't think this is the thing that kills travel, but maybe this is like a turning point toward the thing. Like,
I never said that this was going to kill travel. I just said it's going to make it more of a, I guess you could call it a luxury item. And there are some people who argue that that's the way it should be, given travel's expense against the environment, you know, the carbon emissions it puts off. I, for one, argue that it's terrible for the loss of cultural exchange, but that's just me.
The average middle class person traveling internationally is not putting that, is not that huge environmental thing, because they're doing it once every few years. It's not the bulk of.
Oh man, you talk to anybody from the Green Party, they would so disagree with you. I agree with you for what it's worth, but just that when I did my research on this, it just seemed like every article I read about travel was, we got to keep the planes on the ground.
It's the plastic straw debate. Like, yeah, you probably shouldn't be doing those, but it's a very small part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was quite a rant we went on.
Yeah, but sometimes it's good to do stuff like that. Any closing thoughts, or are we ready to move on?
No, that was my closing thought. I feel better getting that off. That's a little bit lighter.
Yeah, you know what? I do too. I mean, when we came back and I was looking back on the trip from Israel, I was just so ready to scream. And that's why I proposed this topic in the first place. And I do feel better about it now. And, you know, I've got plenty of good memories, good photos. As I said, you know, I'm sure you could talk about how good it was for you to meet with other fathers and other families. My wife has this friend in Israel that she grew up with. who has children of her own. And it was just so good. I mean, I didn't understand a damn thing because they talked in Hebrew, but it was just so good to see her with her friend talking about her kids. I'd not seen my wife look more relaxed in months. So if for that alone, the trip was worth it.
And then you got back on the plane.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hi, Worlds Only listeners. Ian here. Are you craving more Worlds Only content? I got some good news. If you become an AS21 patron, that's exactly what you'll get. See, we usually give you 4 new segments every episode, but we actually record 5 segments. That's right, that's 1 segment a month you're not getting for free, but you can if you join at patreon.com/AS21. By becoming a patron, you'll get our 5th segments, plus more podcast content from AS21, like Publish Me and Passion on the Page. So much great stuff. So if you're jonesing for more Worlds Only and AS21 content, go to patreon.com/AS21. Isn't that right, Silby?
That's right. You love our voices, so now love them even more.
All right, listeners, that is it for the 5th segment episode of the World's Only Podcast, the only podcast in the world. We hope you enjoyed hearing even more of our voices. Ian, where can our listeners come yell at you for not releasing these episodes earlier?
We should blame Keith, but you can find me at iRobertsLibrarian.
I am at Sylvie_says. Thank you, everybody, and Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the World's Only Podcast, a production of the AOS21 Podcast Network, hosted by Podomatic, and available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play. Find us online at media.aos21.com. We'll see you all next month as the world keeps turning.
Copyright 2021, AS21 Media. The AS21 Podcast Network. Your voice, your story, your passion, our mission.